Hey, y'all. How's it going? I'm Scott Horton. Welcome to my show. This is the Scott Horton Show. Hope y'all had a good couple of days there. Welcome back to it. Got a pretty good show lined up for you today. I think I told you last week that Mark Perry was going to be on the show today. Well, that's true. Mark Perry, he wrote this for Politico magazine, Inside the Pentagon's Fight Over Russia. Yeah, nobody's on your side in this one. But anyway, you'll be interested to hear it. Also, Gareth Porter's going to be on to talk about the Syria peace talks, which, you know, I think a lot of us probably would like to hear some good news, but Gareth is going to bear the bad news for us today on the show. And then Keegan Stephan is going to join us again to talk about American civilian human beings shot to death, that is, killed in government-involved homicides. I don't know how anybody could keep track. Well, actually, there's a database. An open source database where they're attempting to keep track. Killedbypolice.net, I believe it is. Anyway, some of the ones over the weekend that I saw and read about in late last week, just so outrageous. Seems like, ringer off. Seems like, I don't know, maybe the kind of stories that could get people to change their minds about the situation, that, you know what, maybe I don't love these guys. Maybe they don't deserve the benefit of the doubt. Maybe we don't need them at all. I don't know. There's only so many examples in a row before you finally reach a critical mass, right? Doomed, I tells you. Oh, yeah, you might have noticed the website is broken. But, it'll be fixed probably before December. You know, I don't know. Whatever. Anyway. That's part of having, my own servers administered by volunteers is, things get done on their schedule and to the degree they feel like it. There's a lot of benefits in it, too. Like, $100 million I've saved on bandwidth providing all these interviews in MP3 format for all of you all these years. So I'm not really complaining. I'm just explaining. There may or may not be a website for a while. If you have any old links to MP3s, then, on descentradio.com addresses, then they'll still work for you. But scotthorton.org is broken. It might be fixed within a couple of days. I don't know. Might could be. All right. Well, anyway, I'm on the Liberty Radio Network. So that's good. Yeah. Well. Anyway. I guess I'm complaining about the Israelis for a minute. IDF shoots dead 73-year-old Palestinian woman on her way to lunch. She's just driving down the street. Guess she didn't see that there were soldiers standing in the street. Well, they saw her coming and thought, oh, look, an enemy trying to run me over. Light her up, boys! And they machine gunned her to death. A 73-year-old woman. Oh, who knows? Maybe she was possessed by the demon Islamic extremism and was trying to kill them all. Somebody sent me a tweet earlier quoting an argument. Well, maybe if they would stop attacking the Israelis with knives, they wouldn't be occupied. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that you need to go back to third grade and pass your cause and effect quiz again. Retake it. They passed you, but they should have made you retake the test. Anyway. Yeah, 73-year-old woman. Yeah, you know what? If the government murdered your 73-year-old mom or your 73-year-old grandma or whoever, then... hey, whatever. They're Israelis, right? They can murder whoever they want, and it's good. And if you don't love it, then you'll go to hell. It says so in the Bible. It says in the Bible that 2,000 years from now, a bunch of atheist communists are going to create a commune on the eastern shore of the Mediterranean here. And then anybody they kill, it's sanctified, and you have to love it, or else I'll make you go to hell forever and ever and ever. Would you believe that that's right there in the New Testament? What a convincing argument. Aren't you blown away? Aren't you afraid that you better fall in line or pay forever and ever and ever and ever in a lake of sulfur burning torture and fire? I know that I, for one, am scared to death. Boy, register me for the Likud party, guys. Register me for the Democrats. Line me up for the Hillary versus Jeb campaign. I put Israel first. No, I put Israel first. No, I put Israel first. I'm voting for both of y'all. Because I'm afraid I'll go to hell forever. Because that's what some guy told me. Yeah, it says in the Bible, the people of the middle part of North America, which as far as we know doesn't exist, 2,000 years from now, they better support the atheists, communists, and secular fascists who don't even believe in God and rule Israel and commit never-ending crimes against little kids all day long. Yeah, or else. Or else you won't be saved after all. I'm sorry, but... whatever, I appreciate people believing whatever religion they want, but the way that people are manipulated into subscribing to these or those politics in the name of religion, well, it's tragic, really, right? It's like believing in politics. I was in an argument about Rand Paul with a Rand Paul bot a couple of weeks ago, who all of a sudden is saying, yeah, we should promise the Kurds their own state. Or you just want to betray them and stab them in the back just like everybody else, right? Now, all of a sudden, just because he's a Rand Paul supporter, all of a sudden now he's found the divine mission of the American Empire to guarantee a free and independent Kurdistan forever. Something that he didn't believe in, never mind the day before, how about even before the argument with me started? Before he had to come up with an excuse for Rand Paul's position on Kurdistan. It's the same kind of stupid thing. And you know, the tragedy of all this is it's all about social psychology. None of this, well, I mean, some of it has to do with reason and this and that, but mostly not. And the greatest example of this, of course, is the anti-war movement before and after Ron Paul. Before Ron Paul, the anti-war movement, in the minds of the average American anyway, meant maybe if we were lucky, Cindy Sheehan, but more likely Susan Sarandon and Jane Fonda and Michael Moore. The communist who calls everybody else greedy but apparently does nothing but eat all day long with his millions of dollars on his pile of millions of dollars. And then Ron comes and says, hey, I'm a white conservative Protestant Christian Texas Republican congressman and I'm anti-war as hell. How do you like that? And all of a sudden it's okay for millions of people to change their mind just because of the country rock and roll dynamic being satisfied there. That's all. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, how's it going, man? Welcome back. Man, yeah, my police state section today is just out of control. I got another one I got to add to my pile here. All right, hey, look, coming up, Mark Perry, Gareth Porter, Keegan, Stefan. First, more Israel stuff. So Netanyahu's come to town to demand more aid. Already America gives them $3.1 billion a year. Now they want five. Give me $5 billion a year as a solve over the nuclear deal, which, of course, was only done to secure Israeli national security and try to get Netanyahu to shut the F up in the first place about Iran's civilian safeguarded nuclear program that's now more safeguarded than ever. And less reason for the Israeli government to pretend to fear than ever before. But anyway, boo-hoo, little prima donna, crybaby Benjamin Netanyahu, half a man at best, has come to cry and beg for more of the money that they take right out of your paycheck so that he can spend it killing people. And then, just to tell Americans in general how absurd we are for supporting Israel. According to Haaretz today, Israel moves to green light 2,200 new settlement units and recognizes previously so-called illegally built unrecognized settlements as legit. As he's getting on the plane to demand more of your money, he outright mocks the explicitly stated policy of every president since Richard Nixon, which is for the Israelis to give up the West Bank. It belongs to the Palestinians, not to them. And just like when Obama sent Biden to go and pressure Netanyahu on the settlements back in, 2010? And they announced the settlements as Biden was in the air. So he would be humiliated. The vice president would be humiliated when he landed. And Biden then punished Netanyahu by sitting on the plane and making him wait an hour before he showed up for dinner. Anyway. Okay, I'm here for my marching orders. Sorry I'm late. And then now, just to humiliate the President of the United States, the leader of Israel's greatest ally, right after he appoints a guy who called Obama an anti-Semite, and correctly but still undiplomatically called the Secretary of State a mental child, after appointing that guy to be the head of Israeli public relations, that sounds about right. That sounds about like every Hasbarist I've ever argued with. Oh, yeah, well, you're an anti-Semite. Yeah, you're really great at arguing. Has an accusation ever rung so hollow as all Israel critics are anti-Semites in 2015? But anyway, I don't know. I appreciate it. I like the fact that Benjamin Netanyahu does virtually nothing to disguise his contempt for the United States of America and for all of our political leaders. And hell, for the humor's sake, I kind of like the way Americans just love it. Kick me in the teeth again. Yeah, give my top secret missile plans to the Chinese. What do I care? Yeah, try to sink my USS Liberty. See if I care. Why don't you manufacture a bunch of fake intelligence in English and funnel it into the stream to help Dick Cheney lie us into war? See if I care. Go ahead and bulldoze Rachel Corrie. Execute Furkan Dogan. Shrug. Oh, Americans are easily moved. It's absurd. That's a direct quote from Netanyahu himself. That you are an idiot for letting him get away with it. That Americans are damned fools for loving Israel anyway. Here's more money, more weapons to colonize the West Bank with. And the thing is about it, it's not like Obama ever actually really tried to do anything about it. It's not that there was ever even a threat that he would. This is all just politics, right? It's not like Netanyahu has to do this in order to preempt Obama's plan to force all the Israelis out of the West Bank. There's no plan. There's no nothing. He's not preempting anything. He's just stealing more land, like always, and taking the opportunity to smack the Americans in the mouth for it. And, yeah, by the way, I urge you to watch it. If you haven't seen, just type in Netanyahu. Absurd. He's talking about us. He's talking about the American people. And just put it right in YouTube there. And you'll see Israeli news channel coverage of it. The translation is not in dispute. From Israeli media. And what it is it's a hidden camera at a settler's house in 2000. And he's talking about how he screwed Bill Clinton right in the face. That's my paraphrase, but I like it. And he thinks the camera's off. You guys gonna turn that camera off? Okay, cool, thanks. But then the guy doesn't turn it off. Or maybe he's nervous and he hits the button twice real quick and it just keeps running. And Netanyahu just sits there blabbing and blabbing and mocking about how he took Bill Clinton to the cleaners on, well, look, all I need is Area C for security, right? But then Area C is 2/3 of the entire West Bank, dude. Ha ha. And he talks, and then the settler says to him, geez, Bibi, if you treat the American people like this, or America like this, too much, isn't it, you know, possible that they'll get mad and it'll end up working against our interest? And he answered that America is a thing that is easily moved. I wish I understood the actual Hebrew. I love the patronizing, you know, tone the whole thing is dripping in. America is easily moved. 80% of them support us. It's absurd. It's absurd the way he can do whatever he wants. And no one will stop him. And in fact, I love this as the perfect little end point on this. From the Times of Israel, star-studded U.S. gala raises $31 million for who? The starving refugees? From America's wars fought on Israel's behalf? No. For the IDF. They raised $31 million for charity. The Israeli army! Jason Alexander, Antonio Banderas, Liv Schreiber, I don't know who that is, the Beach Boys, Gene Simmons. Oh, we gotta raise money for the poor little IDF. You know, so that they can murder children and steal property. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Marky Mark Wahlberg.
Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. You hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. All right, so it's my show, Scott Horton's show. Good interviews lined up for you today. First up, it's Mark Perry, writing again here for Politico Magazine. That's politico.com/magazine. It's Inside the Pentagon's Fight Over Russia. Welcome back to the show, Mark. How are you?
Good to be here, as always.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here. And very interesting article that you have, I guess, to oversimplify, but not too much. You got two very prominent generals inside the Pentagon who have very different plans for how to prepare American forces for war with Russia in Eastern Europe. You know, should that day ever come or anything like that. Is that about right?
That's about right. One of them... Doug McGregor holds that we are not prepared and that given the current setup in the Army, we would probably be overwhelmed in a straight-up fight with Russia, at least initially. And the second, General H.R. McMaster, holds that we're plenty prepared, but if we're going to do anything beyond fighting, we better increase the Army budget and increase the number of soldiers in our military.
Mm. All right, now... I guess this is kind of silly, but is anybody questioning the necessity of any of this when obviously it's NATO expansion and provocations like the coup d'etat in Kiev and the, you know, complete disruption of the Middle East, including support for the Mujahideen against Russia's ally Assad in Syria over the last 4 years? I mean, these are the policies that they carry out, so they know good and well that they're the ones that have provoked whatever Russian response, not that it justifies whatever Russia does or anything, but they know that they're the aggressor here. It's not like the Warsaw Pact is on the march. It's NATO that's on the march in Russian territory or former Russian territory.
Well, thankfully, there are plenty of naysayers in Washington, policymakers who think that we can come to an accommodation with the Russians, that we have been provocative, that we don't need a big military, that we're overspending as it is. You hear this all the time. It's much more prominent now, I think, in the wake of the Iraq and Afghanistan fiascos than it was even a few short years ago. There are plenty of skeptics out there who think that the military consistently exaggerates the threat from any number of potential adversaries, but particularly Russia, that we exaggerate the threat from the Russians, that they are not a threat, and that we're plenty prepared to meet any contingency now without any increase in any defense budget.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. I mean, I read articles like that in the National Interest and that kind of thing, but it seems like at least TV would have us believe that the consensus is aggressive Russia must be rolled back, preempted, stood up to.
Well, I think you're right. It's, you know, I think that this is the real difference between the mainstream media and what you and I might read or watch. You know, we outspend any other competitor by a factor of four, and by the next 10 competitors by a factor of 10. I think that part of the agenda here is that when the military says that we need to meet every contingency and that we're not prepared, that there's real threats out there, what they're really aiming for is to break sequestration. The long-term kind of corralling of the budget. That means ultimately less money for defense and more money for other programs. That's really the focus of their worries. Not Russia, not ISIS. It's that we have budget constraints that put them under pressure to streamline and to be more competent. That's all for the good, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man, you know, I really should have saved this. Maybe I can go back and find it. But there was a quote not long ago. Geez, this could have even been in some of your writing now that I think about it. But anyway, where one of these very prominent generals, it may have even been Ray Odierno or one of them, had said to the Congress, oh, look, yeah, no, I mean, don't get us wrong. We could protect America fine no matter what.
But if you want us to be able to deploy far away for years on end, well, we're going to need some more money and more equipment and more troops. And, you know, usually they don't put it quite that simple, but it rang very true the way they said it.
It's exactly right. And my answer to that is, fine, we won't ask you to deploy anywhere else.
That's what I'm saying.
You know, it's okay with us. You don't want to go into Syria? Fine, stay out. You don't want to go back into Iraq? Fine, stay out. You don't want to fight Russia in the Baltic countries? Fine with us. Let's not do that.
And let's abolish the Northern Command while we're at it. We don't want them to have anything to do, really.
And while we're at it, listen, if Russia wants to go spend $1 trillion in Iraq, I've heard this directly from military officers, senior level, very quietly, who say, listen, if the Russians want to make the same mistakes we did and ruin their economy and overextend their military by deploying in Syria, let them do it. It's a catastrophe. These are conflicts that don't have an immediate solution. They're not amenable by outside force. We're not going to solve their problems by deploying the 101st Airborne, so let's not do it.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so when people talk about, well, so we got a plan for what are we going to do if we have a war with Russia over the Baltics, which are, of course, NATO members. We're sworn to protect them in war if the Russians ever try to take them. You know, we all hear the cliche, right? Oh, come on, they got plans for attack in Canada and plans for attack in Japan again. And there's always a plan on the shelf for everything, even if they're not even contemplating it. But so, like, on a scale of 1 to 10, where does this fall on the level of innocuous war plan for war plan's sake versus something that they're really, you know, worried about and considering and believe that maybe they'll have to do at some point in the not-too-distant future here?
Told me that the most likely conflict we're going to have outside of the Middle East will probably be against Russia somewhere on the eastern borders of NATO. That said, I think the likelihood of that from Russia's perspective is almost negligible. It is true that they could give us a tough time in the early days of a war, but our force and especially our Air Force is so overwhelming. Our firepower is so dominant, that I really doubt Russia wants that kind of a fight. And I doubt we want it either. Now, are we planning? Sure, we're planning, because as you say, we plan for everything. But does that mean it's going to happen? I think we live in an age where, you know, post-Cold War, we get to pick and choose our conflicts. And my point of view, and I think really, you don't hear this from the military, but it's true, they would rather not take on a big fight anytime in the near future.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. I hope that they talk that way to their civilian, leadership, rather than yes, sir, can do, sort of an attitude, which is probably just as likely, but.
You're right. It all depends on leadership.
Well, but now what about this, Mark? I mean, I guess, you know, I was there for the tail end of the Cold War. I grew up in the Reagan years, or I was a kid in the Reagan years, really. But it always just kind of went without saying. If we ever had a real war with Russia, it would be a nuclear war to the bitter end.
It would probably end up being a nuclear war. The least, that's the one option that we really can't have on the table, and it would be a catastrophe. And I think that the incentives are there for. With Russia and with China, with talk, more diplomacy. Are we going to push them from time to time? Sure, we're going to push them from time to time. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's a general awareness that there's a line here we can't go beyond. And whenever we've had that choice or Russia's had that choice, we've recoiled from it. At the height of the Cold War, as you recall, 1983, there was a real war scare. We haven't even come close to that lately. So when the head of the military gets up there to testify at the Senate Armed Services Committee and rattles his sabers and says, you know, it could happen, I'm very skeptical. I think he's saying it could happen because the military, as always, wants a bigger cut of the federal budget pie, and right now they're not getting it.
All right, now, with all your contact with all these military men, you ever hear them complain about, say, for example, the coup d'etat in February of 2014 in Kiev and how the State Department is, you know, causing trouble that they're supposed to bail us all out of? Oh, crap. There's the music and we got to go to break. I'll tell you what. Hold that thought for just a minute. I'll ask you that again when we get back from this short break. And then we're going to talk a little bit more about the actual article here and the combat between generals about what's to be done for war planning in Eastern Europe. We'll be right back with Mark Perry from Politico Magazine right after this.
Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to MPVEngineering.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm on the line with Mark Perry, writing again for Politico Magazine, Inside the Pentagon's Fight Over Russia. So, sorry, I always do a lousy job of timing these breaks here, Mark. I was wondering whether the guys in the Pentagon complain about the State Department neocons and things like the coup d'etat in Kiev. And now their training mission, they're aiding, sending all these armored vehicles and training up their so-called National Guard forces, which, of course, are made up of a bunch of Hitler-loving Nazis and that kind of thing. And this is right on the border of Russia. This is, you know, Russia's Canada there in Ukraine. And I wonder whether you hear much complaining by the brass about what the State Department weenies get them into, get us all into.
Not much. There is some dissent in the Pentagon. There is a great deal more among retired officers, but there is some dissent and a few lone voices who wonder about America's foreign policy and our aggressiveness. There is also a broad base of support inside the Pentagon for the current president's foreign policy, for the non-interventionist part of his foreign policy. And there's also a great deal of skepticism, I might add, since it's an election season, towards Hillary Clinton, who's often described by some senior Pentagon officers as a cruise missile liberal. I think that we're seeing in this a real discomfort with the end of the Iraq and Afghanistan interventions and a realization that they were too costly, were not politically thought through, and that they had a very negative impact on the military. I find very little appetite in the military right now for any kind of military intervention.
All right. Well, so I guess in that sense, you know, training up to fight Russia, the war that never comes after all these years, you know, in the Soviet days and now, is sort of their way of making money, staying in business, but not having to actually really do anything. So in a sense, I appreciate that, except that, of course, they're playing with the biggest matches of all, the H-bombs here, so it's not exactly nothing. But anyway, if you could, please go ahead and get into, you know, these two generals and their competing plans for what ought to be done if it really does come down to a ground war in Eastern Europe to, say, for example, protect Latvia from Soviet or from Russian attack.
Well, these are two generals who have very different and contrasting views of what the U.S. Army should look like. On the one hand, Colonel Doug McGregor thinks that our units, our basic Army units, are not strong enough, are not stand-alone enough, do not sustain themselves enough, do not have the logistical capabilities of taking on a peer competitor like Russia, that we need to change the basic formations in the military. On the other side, General H.R. McMaster, who's actually a brilliant author and historical thinker, believes that what we have now will do just fine, but it's probably not big enough, and that we're going to need to plus up our formations and make them more lethal. I think at the heart of this debate, frankly, are two competing foreign policy divisions decisions that have to be made, whether we're going to go lighter and better and more lethal, or whether we're going to stay the same. It's very hard to get the military to change, and McGregor is asking a lot in his reform plan for how you model an army. But there's a growing perception in Washington that what we have in the army is probably not adequate enough, it's not light enough, it's too armor heavy, it can't get there fast enough, it's too dependent on logistics, too top heavy in headquarters, and that there's going to have to be change.
Mm-hmm. Well, that really works in our favor a lot of times, right? Like in Syria, where Obama says, well, guys, what about a safe zone? And they go, well, Mr. President, we could do it, but we have to bring the entire army with us to do it. And then that's the poison pill. He says, well, no, then.
Well, that's right. We saw this in the Iraq debate about invading Iraq, where, you know, Rumsfeld wanted to go lighter and lighter and lighter, and we couldn't do it. We ended up with 148,000 troops, which is enough to defeat Saddam's army. But lo and behold, somebody in their wisdom among the neocons said, well, we're going to transform the Middle East. We're going to stay there. We're going to occupy. We're going to redo Iraq. And that takes a lot more than 148,000 troops. So, you know, the real question here is, what do we want a military for? Do we want a military that's capable of fighting and defeating our aggressors? Or do we want a military that's capable of fighting and defeating our aggressors and then staying on after we broke the China to repair it? If we really want a nation build, then our army's too small. But if we really want a large army, frankly, we're going to bankrupt ourselves. So it's a real debate here in Washington.
Well, and now, so what about, I think, you know, part of the criticism of on the, you know, which this is narrower than the foreign policy question, but part of the criticism of the capability of the current brigade structure, et cetera, by the McGregor guys. It seems to be, I forget, you know, I wouldn't directly kind of quote out of your article here, but I sort of got the impression that part of the argument is that they've sort of built this army for show in a way. Like the implication is sort of F-35 economics here, where how useful is this thing really going to be when it comes down to it is not the overriding question. The overriding question has a lot more to do with money and power and politics and promotions and ribbons and these kinds of things. And so I just wonder, you know, when it comes down to it, obviously America has ultimately more money and power for the long haul and that kind of thing. But I wonder whose tanks actually, you know, would probably win out in a battle if they really had to fight in Latvia. Are the Americans as big and bad as they think they are? Has they sold themselves as being?
My sense is that if it came down to a fight, there's no question who would prevail. We have an incredible preponderance of force. You take a look at Russia's fighter jets, the Su-34 and Su-35. They're fine. They're good. They're top of the line, but they can't compare with ours. Our engineering, our aerodynamics, our aeronautics are just so much better than anything that Russia or China can put in the field. That it boggles my mind to hear military officers say, well, you know, we'd get beaten. Maybe we'd get beaten initially. Maybe we'd get set back on our heels. But given enough time and enough focus, our military really doesn't have a competitor. And once you understand that, I think it's easier to take your time and try to get the military right, to structure it right. We are entering a new era, and we do need to get it right. But we don't need 630,000 troops in the U.S. Army. Just don't. Mm-hmm. And we don't need to bankrupt our country in doing it. Now, a guy in my position, sitting on the telephone and not in uniform, can sit here and go on and on about the military-industrial complex, and it's going to sound like a cliché. But it's not a cliche. It's true. You know, we often build weapons we don't need, and too many of them for too long, and it takes too much, and we just don't need it. What we need is a much better focus, a lighter, more lethal military to meet our needs, and not 600,000 troops sitting in some Middle Eastern country trying to build a nation. It just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and part of the danger of having one that's not light, but it's heavy and hopefully too heavy to use for transient reasons, if they do use it, boy, do you get a 10-year occupation and 4,500 dead out of it and a giant disaster. So lesson learned there. We're in trouble. We're really in trouble either way without a fundamental rethinking of American foreign policy by everyone, a kind of recognition, like Ron Paul said, that, you know, we could defend this country with a couple of good submarines. We don't need any of this really at all unless our policy is rule the world. But if our policy is protect the people of the middle part of North America, psh, you know, We hardly need an army at all. All we need is a tiny and decent navy and maybe some air power, and that's about it.
Well, I think that we do need to focus. I agree with you. But I think that we need to focus on, you know, real national security interests. No more world wars in Europe. Keep the sea lanes open. Keep trade free, and protect the homeland. Those are the keys. And expeditionary imperial deployments to wherever it's going to be next month, back to Iraq or back to Syria, is just not something that's in our interest. And I'm not alone in saying this. This has been said by Douglas MacArthur and Dwight Eisenhower and George Marshall year after year after year after year. Their acolytes and their disciples have been saying it again and again and again. It's time for us to listen.
Yep, got that right. All right, well, listen, thanks very much again for coming back on the show, Mark. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
All right, you guys, that's Mark Perry writing again for Politico Magazine, politico.com/magazine. The piece is Inside the Pentagon's Fight Over Russia. And we'll be right back with Gareth Porter on the Syrian Peace Talks right after this. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. And that mean old Republicans, man. Donald Trump says, take the oil. That's how to defeat ISIS. Just occupy all the oil fields and starve them out. Good thing the Democrats are here. Because they've got a peace conference. And they're going to conference us up some peace. I guess the Obama administration has finally given up on regime change. They've finally given up on unending war, bleeding both sides forever. And they finally decided, I guess since the Russians called their bluff on ever getting rid of Assad, they've decided, okay, let's all meet at a table and hash this out, and we'll have peace. But, yeah, no, Gareth Porter doesn't seem like he's buying it, because the title of his article is The Sham Syrian Peace Conference, which is my least favorite kind of peace conference. Anyway, hey, welcome to the show. Gareth, how are you? Oh, I hit the wrong button. Hey, Gareth, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm really like a kid in a candy shop with all this stuff going on right now. There's so many things to write about.
Well, I know you type fast, so that's good.
Not fast enough.
We like reading what you write and interviewing you about it. That's the deal. That's the consensus around here. All right, the Sham Syrian Peace Conference. I got to tell you, you know, I'm not really an optimist or anything like that, but I was happy to see. I mean, it must mean something that they actually want to have a peace conference. I mean, the pseudo peace conferences they had back in 2012 were nothing but a sham and a joke, and it was obvious the Americans didn't mean it at all. Assad must leave as a precondition to any negotiating at all, and this kind of, you know, dead letter, ramble yay style offer you can't possibly accept sort of a thing. But now this is sort of kind of different, but no?
No, not really. You know, in fact, the 2000... The 2014 conference that was UN organized was based on not the premise that Assad must go, but rather unconditional negotiations. So, you know, in fact, the Syrians were part of the that UN sponsored set of talks. And of course the opposition didn't want to participate. They refused to participate, at that point, except for the, the moderates who were corralled into the negotiations by the United States. So, in fact, you know, we really haven't advanced very far at all. In fact, I would argue that this is not progress at all from the 2014 talks. So I think, you know, we have to look at a possible or probable other motives, that is, other than the intention to actually force the beginning of negotiations for peace in Syria. I think that, you know, the alternative explanation for a genuine interest in jump-starting negotiations, or the certainly an expectation that that is what is going to come out of these talks, is public relations. And I think that both the Russians and the Americans in this case are primarily using this as an opportunity to advance their public relations interests. I mean, the Russians have an interest in this kind of conference because...
Well, Gareth, your audio's cutting out on us a little bit there. Internet connection problem. You know, Skype is just, it sounds better, but it's just so damn unreliable. It's ridiculous. Hold on, we're trying to get the call back, they say. And of course, it's true what Gareth says, you know, obviously about it being a PR stunt. And the first proof of that is you just look at the picture and it's this huge table full of all kind of barely interested parties participating. Everybody except no Syrians at all. And if it was a real thing, they'd have some kind of Syrians represented there and the most interested parties, Turkey, Saudi, you know, Russia, Iran, not the whole damn EU and the Vatican and whatever, everybody else in the world. All right. Well, you know what? Here, let me play a second audio here and see if I can get Gareth on the telephone, because this is just going to keep messing up here.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist.
You started this damn war. Now you have to deal with it.
And we will. It is just a matter of time before we achieve a complete victory.
You know there won't be a victory. Every day your war machines lose ground to a bunch of poorly armed, poorly equipped freedom fighters. The fact is that you underestimated your competition. If you'd studied your history, you'd know that these people have never given up to anyone. They'd rather die than be slaves to an invading army. You can't defeat a people like that. We tried. We already had our Vietnam. Now you're going to have yours.
It's between them.
I was 21 years old, and I really was wanting to get the war over, and I wanted to get home. And if they told me to go bomb some cities, I went and bombed cities. And they were bombed to... nothing left except steps and chimneys. Complete 100% obliteration. It's not like going out and stick a bayonet in somebody's belly, okay? You still kill them, but you kill them from a distance, and it doesn't have that demoralizing effect upon you.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, really. All right, anyway. I hate Skype. Let's all boycott Skype. Let's hold a big anti-Skype protest in the street because it sucks. Hey, Gareth, welcome back. I'm sorry.
Thanks.
You were talking about it's all big PR stunt. Obviously,
yeah,
we can
yeah.
all tell because there's 100 people at the table, not the most interested parties, but anybody who also wants to be in on a PR stunt. That's all was the qualification for who was invited. But so, and then you were saying at the time that crappy Skype cut out on us that you were going to describe the Russians' PR interest
yeah,
in
I mean,
joining
the Let's face it, the Russians are really big gainers. You know, in this peace conference, because this clearly helps to quiet the criticism of Russia's military intervention, particularly in the United States and in Europe. So they obviously gained from this, and the Obama administration felt that it was in their interest as well to show that, you know, they really do want peace in Syria. And they're doing their best to push the ball forward. And, of course, what they mean by that, you know, the way they define
progress or a movement toward a peace in Syria is that they're going to get the Russians to pressure the Syrians to tell Assad he's got to go, and that's going to be the way that we get this done. And that, of course, is completely in the land of fantasy. I mean, that's simply not going to happen under present circumstances. And that's really the primary point that I'm making in my article.
Mm-hmm. Excluding the Syrians is the proof that they're not even really trying here. But so,
well, I mean, it's proof that this is simply not a realistic exercise in negotiations, because what you have here is the major military forces opposing the Syrian regime in the field are ISIS and al-Nusra Front and their jihadist allies, and neither of those two groups are interested in the slightest in negotiating a peace agreement with any authority in Damascus, because their aim is creating a caliphate on both sides,
yep.
both ISIS and al-Nusra Front and their allies.
All right, so, hold it right there. Go ahead.
That means that the whole notion that you could have a negotiated settlement to end the war, at this point is just a non-starter. I mean, you might potentially get some of the moderates who are still, you know, hanging out there in the field, who are at this point relatively weak to agree, but that's not going to do any. That's not going to make any difference.
All right, hold it right there. Yeah, they're mostly mythical anyway. The moderates. All right, y'all. Got any Skype problems? We'll be right back with Gareth Porter and the fake Syrian peace conference right after this. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with the great Gareth Porter, author of the book Manufactured Crisis, Iran Never Was Making Nukes, Dummy, or something like that. The great book, the definitive book on Iran's civilian nuclear program. And also about 100,000 wonderful articles that you ought to read about what's true and what's not. This one is called The Sham Syrian Peace Conference. And so, I mean, I know the answer is complicated and depends who you ask and who's really in charge and these kinds of things. And so you can use whatever qualifiers you want. But what the hell is the Syria policy at this point anyway? It seems like when John Brennan said, well, you know, we thought about it and we decided that maybe de-Baathification and the complete and total destruction of the Syrian state to the benefit of al-Qaeda might not be a wonderful idea after all. It took us 4 years to figure this out, but now we're thinking that maybe even without Assad, we want the government in Damascus to stay. It seems like he's got to mean that to say that, right? Or no? Have they given up on regime change? What is it that they want at this point?
He does mean that, and in fact, it's not a new position with regard to at least the intelligence community. They have been saying at least for two to three years now, starting in 2013, that they don't want the state structure, and particularly the Syrian army, to be dissolved or to be defeated. And so that has been a pretty standard position, a public position taken by the national security folks in the Obama administration for quite some time. The problem is, as your question, I think, accurately reflects, the White House does not really have a straightforward strategy or plan to deal with Syria. And in fact, what has happened is that the Obama administration has sort of drifted along from one decision to another. You know, for example, going along with Petraeus's idea of a covert operation to arm the moderates, quote unquote, but in conjunction with the with Doha and Riyadh, with that is with Qatar and Saudi Arabia, who really had their own ideas and ended up obviously shoveling a lot of arms into the hands of folks who ended up as part of the al-Nusra front-led alliance. So, I mean, that was really the beginning of this whole trend in U.S. policy to essentially hand over the initiative to the Sunni Arab bloc led by the Saudis, but with Qatar playing a very active role. And I think that really is the fundamental dynamic that has determined the de facto U.S. policy ever since 2013 or you know, early 2014. And that problem looms very large in the future of this whole issue, because it seems very clear that Obama is not prepared to break with the Sunni bloc, with the Saudis. In fact, he is his fealty to the Saudis seems to be complete and unalloyed. At least that's the indication thus far. I can't see any evidence that contradicts that.
Yeah. Well, they do seem to be getting away with the propaganda model here that, well, if ISIS is even more extreme than Al-Qaeda, then I guess Al-Qaeda must be moderate compared
to
ISIS.
Well, in effect, what has happened is that the United States is not just tolerating but cooperating with a strategy that treats al-Nusra Front as a useful instrument in the Syrian conflict. And that means that, in fact, everything that the United States says at a peace conference or about peace, is really, has to be debunked, because it's United States is, in fact, carrying out a policy, a de facto policy that involves using jihadists to try to put pressure put enough pressure on the Syrian regime to force them to basically say, okay, Assad will step down in 6 months or 9 months or whatever, and that is, it's a totally unrealistic objective and a means which are immoral and just crazy.
Hey, treason is the only crime defined in the U.S. Constitution to prevent abuse of that term. But providing aid and comfort to the enemy, in this case, Mujahideen fighters who are sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York City, absolutely qualifies. Right? If we have Attorney General Bruce Fein right now, all these guys would be in prison. All of them.
Well, no doubt that's true. But we shouldn't get our hopes up.
Yeah. No, Ron Paul didn't win in 08. That's the thing.
Yeah.
That's why we live where we live and how we live right now. But now, so check this out. I'm not going to give them credit like they're all smart, like Brzezinski claims to be the genius who lured the Russians into Afghanistan by backing the Mujahideen even before the Soviet Union invaded in 1979. Larissa actually says that, yeah, that's true, but I don't know if there was a reaction or not. But anyway, point is that now that the Russians are in Syria and have called the Americans bluff, I immediately thought, well, geez, maybe that's why they've been backing the Mujahideen all this time. It's not just get rid of Assad for Israel and Saudi. It's lure the Russians into this trap. See if we can cross their line and get them to come in here and get bogged down in a no-win war, just like give them their own Vietnam, just like we keep giving ourselves our own Vietnam again and again and do it to them. And then Robert Gates said before the Senate, apparently Obama's position is just let the Russians get bogged down and weaken them that way. And then Mark Perry was just on the show talking about what the generals think about Russia and all these things. And Mark Perry said that the generals have told him, some of them quietly, he said, have said that they're happy to see the Russians bogged down in a no-win war in Syria and basically let them have it. And it'll be bad for the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, the American people's enemies, if not our government's enemies. And it'll be bad for Russia, who apparently everybody's supposed to hate for whatever reason. So,
okay.
Looks
well,
like there's at least something
really
to it. So what do you think?
Here's what's really going on. I mean, the U.S. really was not expecting the Russians to do this. That simply was not the calculus that has been at work for the last couple of years in U.S. policy toward Syria. I mean, this was a surprise. This was a strategic surprise.
So, yeah, I agree with you about that. So clearly, what about now, though?
But now, of course, yes, these generals are going to be saying that, A, because, you know, it's embarrassing for U.S. generals to be in a position where, you know, the Russians are there fighting in a war that the U.S. opted out of, you know, in terms of actually a major operation. You know, they've had very limited operations against ISIS, and that's the best way for them to sort of save face, really, isn't it?
Yeah,
I mean, you know, to say that, oh yeah, we want the Russians in there because they're going to suffer. And you know, I'm not saying they don't believe this, but I do believe that that's what is at work.
It's post hoc rationalization. I understand.
It's a post hoc rationalization, precisely.
Yeah, of course.
Yep.
All right, now listen, quick, before the music starts playing, tell them about the thing that's happening tomorrow right after this show.
Yes thanks. Thanks very much. This is a very interesting experiment, I would call it, for reinventing, as they call it, the U.S. foreign policy. And I'm going to interpret that to mean U.S. foreign and military policy, because, of course, you can't separate them, and I think everyone would agree with that. But it's being put on at 2 p.m. Tomorrow, Eastern Time, from 2 p.m. to 3:30, and it's going to be a conversation. I'll be involved in it, as well as Bob Scheer and some other interesting people. And what I'm going to do is try to lay out a more radical approach to this problem of reinventing U.S. foreign policy, which says, look, you know, the only way to do that is to basically deconstruct the whole system, which has produced, you know, this state of permanent war. And that is a very difficult long-term process. It's not as easy as saying, well, we ought to have peace building, and we shouldn't have, you know, we shouldn't try to maintain a military balance in the Middle East, or whatever sort of discrete argument you want to make about what our policy ought to be. I'm not against doing that, but it has to be accompanied by something more than that. That's what I'm going to try to lay out. So those people who were listening in, may be interested in following this, and you can make comments or ask questions either online if you go to the Reinvent website, and you can also tweet using the hashtag #SmallRReInvent, so people can join in and participate in this either by asking questions or making comments as well.
Cool. And now, what's the link again to get there?
Okay, the link is at Reinvent. It's the Reinvent.
It's just reinvent.com?
Reinvent.net. Reinvent.net.
.net, okay.
And there will be a page there for this, for the event that has to do with reinventing foreign policy. And that will give them the URL for joining in.
Okay. Awesome, man. And we're into the break now, but I'll tell them again when we get back from the break, and I'll talk about it again on the show tomorrow, too.
Thanks so much.
All right. Bye-bye. Thanks, Gareth. All right, y'all. That's the great Gareth Porter. The book is Manufactured Crisis. Buy it. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday. And The Future of Freedom with FFF Founder and President Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, y'all. Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
All right, I'm boycotting Skype.
I've had it, I tells you.
First, it hangs up on Gareth in the middle of an interview. Now, I can't even get my next guest because his Skype thingy is yellow. Everybody knows that if your Skype thingy's yellow, you can't be called. Your Skype thingy's gotta be green. Turn your Skype thingy green. And not hollow green with white in the middle. Like a yummy lime creamsicle. No. Solid green, please. Like a booger. Or no interview. All right. Well, anyway, whatever, dude. Hey, this is cool. John Cusack interviewed, what's her name? How do you say it again? What was it? Arundhati Roy, who she writes interesting things. I don't read her very often, but I have read interesting things by her before. I like John Cusack. He's kind of a friend of the wife's, and I interviewed him one time if you want to hear it. Oh, at my website that right now you can't get to. Actually, if you can hear this later on MP3 format, then the website must be back up again, and so you can. If you're listening live right now, well, then you're kind of out of luck. But anyway. All right. Well, I'm going to read that later. Geez, I'd hate to steal all Keegan Stephens' thunder by talking all about all the people killed by the cops this week and all the news along those lines. How about 35 House war opponents push for vote on ISIS war? New letter cites Syria development as a significant escalation. A bipartisan group of members of the House of Representatives have issued an open letter to Speaker Paul Ryan calling for a vote on an authorization for the use of military force against the Islamic State, citing, quote, deepening entanglement in the conflict by President Barack Obama. Oh, this is Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Under the War Powers Act, the president must seek congressional approval for any overseas military operation within 60 days. That is incorrectly phrased, I'm sorry. The president has no right to launch a war under the War Powers Act. He has every right to defend the United States from attack for 60 days if it takes as that long to get Congress to assemble to vote to authorize it. In every other circumstance, the War Powers Act, I mean, in every circumstance, really, the War Powers Act is Congress's reservation of their Article 1, Section 8 power to determine whether the United States goes to war or not. They passed it over Nixon's veto with supermajorities in both houses to restrain the power of the government. It does not give the president license to begin wars, only to defend the United States. And even when he starts to defend the United States, he still has to have the Congress assemble and authorize it to continue after 2 months max. And that's, of course, imagine that there's some kind of nuclear attack, some kind of devastating attack that would prevent the Congress from assembling immediately to authorize it. And it's not all Jason's fault, because everybody gets this wrong. It's like the consensus, but all you got to do is read it. And the War Powers Act does not say anything about presidents can start wars now. Anyway. The launching of the war against the Islamic State in the summer of 2014 put that vote in the middle of a midterm election. Remember, they sold that even to Reason magazine as a humanitarian mission to go rescue the Zaydis. Oh, here's our guest. And so here we are, a year and a half in a thing. They're fighting in former Iraq and escalating in former Syria, eastern Syria. And Congress is not going to vote on it, apparently. But anyway, we got our guest, so let me get him on the line for us here and talk about the murder of cops for a minute, because there's so many cops. So many dead, innocent people.
All right. Our guest is Keegan Stephan. You can follow him on Twitter at KeeganNYC. And that's also his web address, Keegan.NYC, which I didn't even know that was a thing. But there you go, Keegan.NYC. That's his web address. And, yeah, welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Thanks. I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
I'm doing good. Appreciate you joining us here again. And, yeah, so he's an anti-police brutality activist. And, again, is joining us to talk about some of the people who've recently been killed by the cops. But I appreciate your suggestion in the email last night, Keegan, that we start with these four cops lied about getting shot.
Yeah,
and then blamed it on the Black Lives Matter movement. You say you've got the right to not be murdered? Why, you're inciting murder against me, they cry.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking that this whole movement to, you know, have accountability among the police has created just a backlash of the police saying, like, absolutely no, there should be no accountability, and attacking the people, you know, advocating for accountability.
Forget the unions. I think they should have their own political party. The police political party, their only interest is the cops at the expense of everybody else, and let's not pretend.
Yeah, you know, I found in some of my research recently that a lot of the police unions actually have, you know, super PACs, the political advocacy campaigns that can make donations above and beyond individual donations. So, you know, we're halfway there.
Hell, they'd probably win. People be like, finally, the party we've been waiting for.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge union. They've got a lot of money for sure to be donating to.
Yeah, Palin one time said about Obama, she said, we don't need a lawyer at a lectern. We need a commander to command things. The crowd went wild. So, yeah, we ought to not pretend that we're immune from this kind of thinking, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so tell me about these four cops, though, seriously, because it sounds like, nah, you must be lying. This is crazy talk.
I mean, yeah, I think that most people probably heard about the one case, this cop who was this cop from Illinois, Fox Lake, you know, was trending on Twitter. People were talking about this. It came out last week. And this was probably the biggest story because this cop was killed. And he, you know, it looked like he was murdered in the line of duty when it happened. This was last month. You know, news channels, politicians even were blaming Black Lives Matter movement. Because before he was killed, he identified some suspects and one of them was black. And so everybody jumped on it saying it was, you know, a political murder by the Black Lives Matter movement of a cop. And, you know, everything about the case pointed to a murder. He was shot multiple times. His gun was found like, you know, 20 feet away. And then it turned out that the whole thing was fabricated by this guy. And, you know, he was part of this tactical unit that investigated crime. So he had like an in-depth knowledge of how to manipulate a crime scene to make it look like a murder. And he had done all of those things. He implicated, you know, three people. So there was like a manhunt going on that could have obviously ended very, very poorly for.
Wait, stop right there. That's a point worth really elaborating that apparently he saw three men, two white men and a black man, and said, and then reported that, oh yeah, this is the description, so that there would be some real people to pin it on, not just, you know, a vapor for the cops to chase on a snipe hunt, but here's three guys to pin it on if you want to.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way that, you know, people who are accused of killing cops get treated, those people could have very likely been shot and killed,
right,
when being pursued. So,
very good point. And or the cops could have just decided, yeah, we are going to prosecute them and give them the chair.
Yeah, and people who are, you know, accused of killing cops tend not to get the most fair and due process. So yeah, very dangerous situation he set up for these three innocent people. And then it turned out he staged the whole thing for like extremely nefarious reasons. You know, he had been robbing from a fund set up to train young police officers, teenagers who wanted to become cops. He was stealing money from this, like, you know, ostensibly charitable campaign to fund his own porn addiction and vacations for his family. And he was being investigated by, you know, a new sort of internal affairs investigator in the department. And he was worried that he was going to get caught. His original plan to not get caught was to kill the internal affairs person. Apparently, he made some moves toward hiring a hitman to kill her when he found out that this wasn't going to work, or figured out that this
probably
wasn't.
Hey, Keegan, come on. At least ultimately he did the right thing. Okay, I'm sorry. Hold it right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with Keegan Stephan right after this. Keegan.NYC. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm talking with Keegan Steffen about our Imperial Standing Army of Lawless Killers, a.k.a. the peace officers of your local sheriff's department, city police force. All right, now, Keegan, we got to get through the cops hurting themselves and blaming Black Lives Matter here real quick, because we got a lot of dead people to honor and to accuse their murderers over here, too, before the top of the hour. So we talked about the suicide of this cop who staged, who tried to frame up a bunch of people he saw walking nearby before he killed himself, and it was all because he was a corrupt criminal scumbag and was caught for it, and even had plotted to murder the internal affairs officer, as you said, before finally ending it for all of us. But it should be noted, too, that they had a huge manhunt and all this stuff, pretending that they were finding the real killers, when in fact they knew it was a suicide from the very beginning, or had plenty of reason to believe anyway. But I'm sorry. Anyway, if you could wrap up the other three here real quick so we can talk about all the other the giant pile of skulls these people are piling up like Pol Pot.
Yeah, the main thing is that everybody was aware of this Fox Lake killing, but you know, it was just one of, you know, many police who have been killed this year that have been blamed on Black Lives Matter. But you know, when I heard about this, I started remembering all the articles I've been reading recently, and I pulled them together, and I quickly found that in the last month there had actually been 4 cops who were shot that blamed imaginary perpetrators. And who turned out to all be lying, and who had all like shot themselves or been shot by their partners, and all of whom had come up with elaborate stories, you know, incriminating other people. One, you know, said it was 2 Black people who committed a drive-by in a car. One, you know, said their vehicle was fired upon by an SUV. Another one said he was shot at a traffic stop. So all feeding this like mad frenzy of Fox News and associates blaming the Black Lives Matter movement, and all turned out to be false. 4 in 1 month is actually like a really large percentage of the amount of police officers shot. So It definitely goes to discredit the Ferguson effect and all of its backlash.
Yeah, man. And that's the real point, is just how much mileage right-wing media in America has gotten out of these shootings. And in, you know, it's like lies about Iran's nuclear program. It doesn't matter that none of them are true. As long as there's an endless stream of accusations, it seems like it all must be at some point. And so virtually the entire American right now, you know, is under this impression that the poor little cops are under siege by the evil Black civil rights protesters.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to go back and change people's minds once they get a narrative, you know, lodged in their
That's really tough. Well, you know, I think an important way is, and this is cynical and horrible, don't get me wrong, but whatever. It's important, you know, I think an important way to break through to people is show them dead white people at the hands of the cops, too. Like this 6-year-old boy, whose life has more value in America than that? A 6-year-old little white boy killed by a couple of cops. Or this guy, the Idaho rancher, who's living the American dream, who split logs for 20 years to build this little place for him and his wife to live out their days, and just outright executed on the side of the road for what? Not even the temerity of defying the sheriff deputy's orders, but basically just doing what everyone expected of him, shooting the crippled bull in the back of the head. And they just spun him around and shot him to death as though they had just said it. Well, he does have a gun in his hand. I bet we could get away with it. Let's murder him. There was no other incentive for them to murder him other than the fun of it. And he was white as could be. And they're going to get away with it as though he was the poorest, fatherless black kid in the ghetto, too.
Yeah, these were all pretty, pretty shocking cases. I mean, the case of that 6-year-old could not be more stark. You know, the cops to begin with were violating federal law by opening fire, or federal jurisdiction or federal rules, by opening fire on a moving vehicle. Even though they were completely in the wrong to begin with, and they killed this 6-year-old white child, the news media and the police came out immediately saying that, the father in the car probably had a gun, probably fired at them, might have even killed his own child, totally trying to deface, this individual and absolve the police of all wrongdoing. And then, you know, there was video evidence, luckily, and all of that turned out to be false. And now these police officers have been indicted. There's a silver lining there. However, these cops never should have been on the job. They have these outrageous records of past abuses, escalating even to aggravated rape that one of them was indicted for. They have 5 open lawsuits, including breaking the arm of a 14-year-old girl on a school bus, pepper spraying a 15-year-old at a 4th of July celebration. And yet they were active duty cops, you know, policing the community with guns. It turns out that one of their fathers was an assistant DA in the town, a small town with only 8 assistant DAs. So It's probably easy to imagine why all these charges were dismissed or disappeared or didn't result in any disciplinary action.
And weren't they marshals? I think I read a thing about the city police or the county sheriffs or somebody were complaining that these guys are patrolling in our jurisdiction where they don't belong.
Yeah, one of them is city marshal. There's all sorts of like overlap of police forces in this town, it seems. But none of them, you know, had in the past recused themselves or drawn any attention to this to get any sort of reform.
They'll get $50 fine and time served like on night court. That's it.
Yeah, it is interesting to see a couple things here. You know, I think the parallel with Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old black child who was killed in Ohio, the officer who killed him, even though that's also on video and he gave no time for Tamir to drop the toy gun, before shooting and killing him. It's a year later and that cop hasn't been indicted. So the racial disparity is very clear. However, even though these cops were indicted, I don't think we should have any faith at this point that they are going to be convicted of a crime and spend any time in jail. Mm-hmm. And I think that's clear by this other case I sent you of,
Think it's just the race thing. I think in this case, it's the jealousies of the different jurisdictions involved, where the city police are happy to go ahead and arrest these marshals because they're not of them. They're a separate team. So go ahead.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, we'll see how
that's part of it anyway.
The line goes. Yeah. I mean, but there is a tendency for anybody, you know, sort of extending the favors of the badge, right? That go from one police force to another.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm just saying, you know what, if they had been the regular city police on the job or whatever, they probably would not have been indicted
also,
at all.
Or been charged.
And it'll be interesting to see what happens with this thing in Idaho where they had no cause, and the Idaho Statesman has a great write-up of this. There's absolutely no cause to kill this guy, but he did have a rifle in his hand, and you know that they're just going to go, but judge, waistband or whatever, and get away with it.
It's pretty crazy, especially because the police called the rancher. Like, they were like, you know, this guy's bull's on the loose. We need help getting it under control. And the guy shows up with his gun. Like, of course, you know, he's a rancher. He's like, there's like a bull on the loose. Like, what would you expect someone like this to be doing? And it seems like, the police completely overreacted, viewed him as a threat, murdered him without him firing any shots, which is, you know, this sort of crazy standard operating procedure when we hear about, police involved shootings. Like, even when people have guns, like, very rarely, do they shoot first or shoot at all. And the police, for some reason, are still justified in opening fire. So people who are potentially legally carrying in open carry states, are being killed because people are saying it's justified because they have guns, even though they're completely justified in having those guns.
Right. Yeah, the Washington Post had its big thing about everybody killed by the cops so far this year and how many of them had weapons in their hands. And I guess especially if they have brown skin, you're supposed to assume they had that weapon to commit a crime with. But why? Why do we assume that? This is America. Everybody's got weapons, so we can defend our lives in case somebody tries to commit a crime against us. And what's funny about, I mean, not funny, but in a haha way, but in a horrible kind of way, is you look at Tamir Rice, the little boy with the gun. Well, he is black and he is wearing a sweatshirt and, and, you know, whatever. And somebody called the cops on him because he was terrified. And so the cops made a bunch of bad assumptions on the way to the scene, apparently, and acted them out in this crazy kind of way. But like in this case, you get, in other words, I can see where people can figure out rationalizations for this. But like in this case, who in the world believes that the rancher got a phone call that his bull had been hit by a car and was mad down at the scene and needed to be put down and thought to himself, finally, here's my chance to execute two sheriff's deputies for arriving on the scene. I'll show them. Nobody believes that. That's crazy. Obviously, he just went down there to shoot the bull. How in the world could it possibly be that anyone could imagine that he meant to cause any harm to anyone, you know?
Yeah, and that's sort of the standard for prosecuting the cops, is that they acted outside of reasonable behavior, and we'll see how that plays out, I guess, in the eyes of the jury.
Yep. And, you know, it's funny about the Tamir Rice thing where, as you said, they gave him no warning. They pull right up on him, and the cop just gets out and shoots him. And as you said, it's on video, and in fact, them beating the crap out of his sister who came to try to save his life is on video as well. And they just skated away with that clean. They got sovereign immunity, all of them, either outright or de facto. They've got a license to kill us, Keegan. That's the deal, man. Listen, thanks for coming back on the show. I'm sorry we're out of time. Let's do this again soon. See y'all tomorrow. Thanks.